This is an example of speech.
Oh, hi. Welcome to Tell Me What to Think, a free from oversight and free of charge, thoughtfully improvised, expletive deleted, details expanded, whistle blow hard, evergreen topical heatwave of a weekly conversation turned podcast in which we discuss politics, global affairs, current events, music, literature, social media, and anything else that bubbles up from the unmoderated comment section in our brains. We urge you to join us and tell us what you think. I'm Peter Elbro. You can contact me on Twitter at Bloated Nemesis. And I have with me always and forever Charles Minnick. Actually, I have with me guest host Dave Egan, who can be found on Twitter at Drunkly Ocetus. It's DrunkleOsetus. This episode, we have our weekly intro segment, Weak Thoughts, about impeaching Clarence Thomas and the Trump administration not filling jobs in government, a deeper dive into the Second Amendment, Twitterocracy's reaction to copyright infringement, and more. Prepare to get royally revolutionary. This is Tell Me What to Think. Time to get in our soap pod and tell you what to think. Now, for some Weak Thoughts. Welcome to Weak Thoughts and Tell Me What to Think. Dave, this is your first time on the podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
I saw you said that there was a Supreme Court ruling today, and surprise, surprise, looks like Clarence Thomas dissented in it.
Yeah, he seems pretty mad.
You could pick up emotions from his dissent.
Normally, dissents are full of the sort of language like, oh, I respectfully disagree with my learned colleagues, and Justice Thomas's dissent today was a little peeved, because he's written this same dissent a few times now, every time the Supreme Court denies cert on a gun control case, and so he's getting tired of making the same arguments.
Okay. Well, I could imagine that. I would think the rest of the court might be tired of hearing his arguments, though.
Yeah, maybe.
So I actually want to talk about Clarence Thomas. There was an article written by Jill Abramson in New York Magazine about the case for impeaching Clarence Thomas. And the premise of it is that he lied during his confirmation hearings, which were famous for being about sexual harassment of Anita Hill. And I think it's kind of timely because the issue of sexual harassment is sort of, you know, obviously a big deal lately. And I just wanted to ask you not so much should he. I mean, people can read the article themselves. What would that mean to you, like impeachment hearings versus I don't think it's been done in our lifetimes.
For a Supreme Court justice?
Yeah, as far as I know.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Is that feasible? Is it reasonable? Is it a precedent? It's dangerous or something like that? I don't know. What do you think?
I think given the current political environment, it's potentially dangerous because an impeachment is sort of a political referendum on a sitting office holder, and because the political branch is removing them from office. And even though there are reasons, like there may be evidence that Justice Thomas lied during his confirmation hearing, and that there are... there's a new accuser that has come forward since he's been a sitting justice that is accusing him of new allegations of sexual harassment. It's, you know, it suggests that this is ongoing, but it's, you know, sort of a principle in our society that we don't rehash these sort of issues after they've been decided. Mm-hmm. And I think there would be a great deal of justified backlash at an attempt to impeach Justice Thomas over the issues that were gone over during his confirmation hearing.
Okay. Yeah, and even if they... there was a failure in the hearings, it, you know, that's the fault of the political branch at the time, then.
Right, like in the legal system, we've got formalized rules about you don't reopen a conviction or an acquittal after more evidence comes to light unless there are certain circumstances that, you know, mean that the both the procedure was flawed and that the new evidence is extremely significant.
Mm-hmm. So along these lines, there's been that the gerrymandering issue in Pennsylvania, that their Supreme Court ruled that the Pennsylvania legislature had gerrymandered beyond a reasonable... I guess there's a certain amount of gerrymandering that most people think is okay, but they went too far. And their legislature, I don't know if they've taken steps to this, I don't think they have yet, but has threatened to impeach all of the members of that majority decision from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court.
Yeah, I'm not sure where that is procedurally right now.
So, kind of thinking in terms of a left-right dichotomy here, what if they did that? Might a good backlash be to be, well, fine, we're going to get rid of Thomas and maybe Gorsuch while we're at it.
Like, you impeach some judges in Pennsylvania for getting rid of your fixed elections, and we're going to impeach your pro-gun control judge?
Yeah. I mean, I guess either side can set the precedent, the dangerous precedent is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and that's true. Yeah. And we're... I still think either side setting the precedent is a dangerous precedent.
Yeah. Okay, so, but now here's the last thing I'll say on this. And this, you can kind of tie this into presidential impeachment, I guess. But in general, there seems to be a really strong unwillingness to do any sort of impeachment in this country. It's rare that judges are impeached. I think it happens occasionally, but it's for really blatant corruption, as far as I understand. It's usually not, you know, these are obviously not Supreme Court judges. Presidents, we've had a couple impeached, never taken out of office. Threat of impeachment to Nixon got him out of office, but that's pretty rare. To me, I actually would like to see, regardless of it being Supreme Court justices or presidents necessarily, I personally would like to see more impeachment, because to me that means more accountability. Like, I'm not really worried about the occasional person being taken out of office that didn't do that bad of things, when to me impeachment is the recourse of handling corruption in the judicial and executive branches.
No, that's not necessarily the case. I mean, the FBI is the department that handles corruption in mm-hmm. federal offices, you know, and going through the impeachment process is more cumbersome and more, you know, more of a political showpiece than it is a judicial prosecution.
But isn't part of that because it's rare? I mean, so every time, I know for presidential impeachment, anytime this comes up, it's like this whole new thing, and all the congressmen have to do all this research, and their staffs have to look into the legality and the constitutionality, and it becomes this long process. It seems partially because it's not done very much. No one's used to it. And in terms of it being a showpiece, if that was more regular, it might not be as showy. It just might be, hey, this is our job. Might be a mundane thing at some point.
Yeah, but I mean, what you're describing is the federal courts, because that's Mm-hmm. You know, we've spent a couple hundred years refining that process and coming up with the procedures and putting in place all of the enumerated and specific rights and protections for the defendant and the ways of introducing evidence and what sort of evidence is admissible and what's not relevant. And like you said, for an impeachment, you know, they would be inventing all new rules of what evidence is acceptable. Mm-hmm. And that was the problem with the Clarence Thomas hearings, is that they decided to exclude commentary about his personal life, which might have indicated the truthfulness of Professor Hill's testimony.
All right. Well, I'm still going to hold out for a few impeachments, but that's it's a good point, and with how low the public opinion is of legislatures on the national level, and I'm assuming on state levels, they probably don't want to take that big of a step anytime soon.
Yeah, they would be reviled by everyone.
Yeah. More so than they would lose that 13% approval they have.
Yeah.
That they're just clinging on to. All right. So we were also going to talk about, there was news this week. The Office of Science and Technology Policy is essentially being run by a guy named Michael Kratsios, who is a 31-year-old political science graduate from Princeton. You know, not a scientist. And he used to be a chief of staff for Peter Thiel, who's the right-wing Silicon Valley nutbag.
Yeah, he's the techno-fascist.
I think he has a stock in whatever one does, like, the big data stuff for NSA.
He's Palantir?
I
believe he's the developer of Palantir.
Yes! Oh, fuck, I hate Palantir because of that name. That could be a whole other segment, just my total anger at the misappropriation of that name. So Michael Kratsios, he was nominated now to take the position. He's been the deputy head, and there hasn't been a nominated head, but it's officially now.
That explains the headlines then. So he was serving by default because of the rules of succession, but...
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's terrible. We don't need a scientist to explain how not having a scientist run an office of science is a bad idea. But I think you and I, and we've talked a little bit about it on the show in terms of diplomatic community. But this failure of the Trump administration to fill government jobs is something that is pretty terrible and I think you wanted to talk about.
Yeah. I mean, for this particular post, and probably for most of the political ones, there's no way this post is ever going to be filled. Because it's obvious what kind of person Trump is. And no one that's both good at science or the relevant technical thing that the political appointee needs to be good at to serve in these jobs, no one that's good at science and politics is going to be able to afford the inevitable embarrassment and scandal that will come from working in the Trump administration. Even if they're a person that avoids scandal assiduously themselves, Trump will drag them into something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's probably why so many of these ambassadorial posts, which are, you know, have been regarded as cushy do-nothing jobs for, you know, that are handed out as freebies to political supporters, are empty in the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. There's no deep bench of talent to go to because it would ruin your political career to be in the Trump administration.
Yeah, it actually sort of ties into what led to some of what's going on with the Trump-Russia scandal and all that is... George Papadopoulos and Carter Page were part of this National Security Council. And part of the reasons those two idiots were part of that council is because, in general, the foreign policy and national security community completely shunned Trump. And it doesn't really get brought up in headlines today, but you can see the effects of it going back to the campaign and still today. There's not a deep group of not just Republicans, but the crazy Trump brand of Republican that he can fill these with, and other people are refusing, and it's damaging. Well, this past weekend, John Oliver had one about the world, had a report about world opinion of us being damaged because of this. But it's happening domestically with departments as well.
I think it's also damaging our future ability to have effective governance and to be able to fill these positions in future administrations, even future Republican administrations. Hmm. People that might be inclined to work for a Republican institution or administration in one of these political science offices, the people that are available for that now are moving into other jobs. They might be becoming administrators of long-term science projects. We hear there are constant stories about people leaving American science and going to European science, mm-hmm. because Europeans are putting money into science, and so we're losing the best talent, and they're being driven away because we're not funding science that's not, mm-hmm. you know, politically favored by the current ruling administration. And that's happening in non-science positions as well. We're losing this well of talent and this deep bench to go to other careers. And when they move to these other careers, they're going to be entrenched in these other jobs, and they're not going to be available in the future.
Yeah. I mean, and that could have effects in terms of making the corporate world that much more powerful than government, because they're going to have better human resources, as if they maybe didn't already. But, you know, who wants to work in government, at least right now? I mean, you're going to at least lose a few years of getting people out of college into the diplomatic corps, into science, and any other, you know, thousands and thousands of jobs in the federal government. And I think you were saying how it would hurt future Republican administrations. Are you saying that because Republicans in general are becoming so anti-government that it's going to be hard for them to find people who agree with them and want to work in government?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. It's just, on the one hand, it's just a matter of building up your bench and training your people. You need to have people at all levels of an organization, and those people are going to follow their mentors around. Like good person that's working in academia now will bring their graduate students into the administration and into their departments, and will feed the, you know, they'll feed the Republican Party with skilled operatives and skilled workers that are going, you know, able to be developed for the future, for future political positions and or for future you know, deep state jobs. Sylvester V. Becerra.
Yeah. And Clarence Thomas had that dissent in it. And so I want to ask you a little bit about some Supreme Court rulings on guns. Because a lot of the gun control debate is, should we talk about it? That's mostly what the discussion seems to be. Like, every time this happens, like, are we allowed to talk about it? And finally, there's some high schoolers that are, like, calling BS and just talking about it, which is, like, the coolest thing. It's so punk rock. Good for them. And so, I mean, I don't... Neither of us are public policy experts. I mean, there's tons of ideas out there about different things to do about, you know, restricting access to these guns, waiting periods. I think this ruling was about a California waiting period.
Yeah, it wasn't exactly... They didn't reach any decisions. What they did is they denied the appeal to be heard by the Supreme Court. And Justice Thomas is upset about that because he thinks the Ninth Circuit applied the wrong legal reasoning to the case.
Okay. But I mean that, so that'll uphold the waiting period, right?
Yeah, it's about California's 10-day waiting period, and it looks like it was struck down at the district court, but then upheld by the Ninth Circuit. Okay. And because the Supreme Court isn't going to hear it, then the California's 10-day waiting period stands.
Yeah, saying lots of waiting periods, and you have to register for this. Other countries do things like mental health checks, drug checks, criminal backgrounds. I saw in Israel you give up some sort of right to privacy. There's all types of ideas around the world. And I'm just kind of wondering, like, what would be explicitly not allowed here because of established precedent? Or could you talk about...
Yeah. So a lot of people are talking about the Israeli gun control laws. And this particular case gives us some light on how some of those things would be received. Because... not only was there a 10-day waiting period, but the 10-day waiting period was in place to allow the state to do mental health checks.
Oh, okay. But interesting.
They weren't exactly testing the individual in the way that the Israeli system does. These were just checking to see if the person had ever been, had ever popped up in any sort of database.
Okay.
But, so the relevant cases in this are... there's D.C. versus Heller, which was the one that made possessing a firearm an individual right and resolved the dispute about whether there was a militia requirement,
whether
it was a collective right.
That kind of assumed to be a thing for a while, but it wasn't actually established until then, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And that's another point that Justice Thomas makes in his dissent today, that there's a lot of jurisprudence left to go over, and there are a lot of gray areas in the Second Amendment that haven't been decided yet.
Well, I mean, that's actually a valid... that makes some sense to me. I mean, it sort of seems like because he wants it to go a certain way, but...
Right.
That's reasonable.
Right, but so since Heller was in Washington, D.C., it didn't resolve certain aspects of the legal technicalities, because the Bill of Rights doesn't necessarily apply to the states unless the Supreme Court has then applied them through the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, and that's what McDonald versus Chicago did, which was a couple of years after Heller.
Okay.
And these things are... In the dissent today, Justin Thomas was saying that Heller set the standard for the legal standard for which gun control regulations should be reviewed, and he says that it set that standard at strict scrutiny. And the Ninth Circuit disagrees. The Ninth Circuit, drawing on some sort of weak precedent, but some precedent and some scholarly research, says that there's, and they also, by analogy to the First Amendment, say that there can be lower levels of scrutiny that will allow these regulations to survive, because strict scrutiny is the sort of legal standard that says no government regulation of an individual right will survive strict scrutiny.
Okay.
But intermediate scrutiny is that, you know, the government regulation that restricts the individual right has to be reasonable and reasonably tailored, and that the government interest has to be important interest.
Okay, which, I mean, on the surface you could see applying to something like this.
Right.
Yeah.
And those sorts of things are debatable, and that's why they go through a lot of analysis by judges, and they have to have all kinds of evidence and stuff. And legislators are bad at passing... rational basis scrutiny, because when they pass legislation, those things tend to be based on politics rather than on any sort of rational study of the issue.
Yeah. Huh. So what I'm kind of hearing here is that there is room for states to take a more active role.
Oh, yeah. Is that, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
And that's where most of the regulation is going, is probably going to have to take place. Like, federal regulation would be simpler to push through a political process, and it would be less patchy, because it would be the same everywhere. But there are limits to what the federal government can do, and in the past, federal gun control regulations have been struck down by the Supreme Court as exceeding the federal government's powers to control the states.
Oh, okay. Not so much directly because of the Second Amendment, but because of states' rights. Is that?
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Is there anything that, when it comes to what a state could do that you know of that would be explicitly not allowed? Or is that part of what Thomas is saying, is that there's so much gray area here that as of now, they can do tons of... Yeah, okay.
Well, that's the thing, is that there's a ton of gray area, and even Scalia, when in the Heller opinion, left room for lots and lots and lots of gun control regulation. And I think Scalia's other writings indicate that he would have been open to a great deal more gun control regulation than many people would suspect.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there are certain regulations that would probably be more or less likely to survive, because Heller does at least specifically give an individual the right to have a revolver in their own home for self-defense purposes.
Okay. Did it restrict your ability to, and how you obtain it, though? Like these waiting periods, these, you know, passing tests, anything like that?
Now, Heller and McDonald didn't really address the waiting periods.
Okay.
But I think Heller does have something to say about the waiting periods, because D.C. is notoriously restrictive on issuing gun licenses, and that's really where gun control regulations that are written well and written, you know, in a way that would technically pass muster in the courts could fail, because if they're applied by a local government that's acting in bad faith to get rid of guns, and or if they're being run by a bureaucratic dictator that wants to, you know, control the world and only issue guns to people that they, you know, personally approve of, those sorts of, you know, practical problems would be the end of good gun control regulation.
Okay. Is there anything else, any other thoughts you had on, now, do you have any personal opinions on things that might be good ideas, or on ways to go about, I don't know. Any other thoughts you had? Tell me what to think. Come on, Dave.
Yeah, they're all kinds of great things. Like, it's amazing how much just knowing the facts about something can control the spin of a political debate. Mm-hmm. So just allowing government funds to be spent for health-based research on gun violence, you know, having legitimate statistics from electronic records of gun sales and thefts and gun crimes, that mm-hmm. sort of things, the much more accurate records of gun violence and police violence and the circumstances in which guns were used, like whether they were used for suicide or for a mass shooting or for in the drug trade or in human trafficking, those sorts of things would be much more useful to direct the debate. Because like you said, we can't... The debate is whether or not we can even talk about things. And of course we can't talk about anything until we have facts.
Is the ideal situation.
Yeah.
Right. No, that's interesting. It reminds me of like the police shootings, which would be, you know, gun violence type thing, where there's not, I believe this is still the case, at least it was, a centralized database with reliable information about police shootings of civilians around the, across the country. Because every, the way I believe it goes is that every local community is like voluntarily gives that information out and, to, I think, the FBI.
Yeah, and I don't think the FBI includes that information in the Uniform Crime Report that they issue every year.
Yeah. And so I think there have been some media outlets that have tried to kind of compile this as best they can until we even know exactly. Because you can always have someone saying, well, it's not a problem. I think that's the main reason you need the information, is because you have to be able to definitively say there is a problem or definitively say there isn't a problem. And you don't really know that until you know, especially when you're talking about a country that's huge, until we have rates, you know, until we have percentages and numbers.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. At this point, the discussion is all just posturing and opinions. But yeah, there are all sorts of things that could be done. Like, you know, you mentioned the Israeli regulations. Like, they have, you have to have a genuine reason. And I think that is one of those things that could be written well and applied poorly and get overthrown. They have some sort of regular annual or semi-annual renewal of your license where you have to pass a test and that sort of thing. And that, that it is another one that might be questionable, but you know, most of the those restrictions that they have on, like, number of guns, amount of ammunition, the types of guns that you're allowed to possess, are all things that several other countries do and things that we haven't really tried that could still be acceptable.
Yeah, because I think there's some things that strike me as, you know, I'm not a gun owner. I mean, I'm not really pro or against guns, really, that inherently. But there's something that strikes me as un-American by asking, well, why do you want to have a gun?
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, I don't think we need that. I mean, what? Because if you are going to be a mass murderer, you're not going to say it. You know, I don't know. People can lie easily enough. It's, but, you know, meeting some sort of defined standard of people always bring up the driver's license, which isn't the strictest thing. I mean, there's horrible fucking drivers out there, but, you know, we still have something. We're trying to have some sort of test you pass, and you have to renew that, like, you know, like with a car, you have to renew that license every so often. And yeah, I mean, I think one of the best takes I've heard in the past week or so since the shooting is just the really simple one of, well, why don't we just try something? Like, there was a history of, in this country, of trying different ways of doing them. Some of them have been struck down by courts. Some of them have just lapsed the legislation itself. Some of them maybe did help. Some of them didn't help. But the debate has been totally taken over the past two decades by the pro-gun groups. I mean, I noticed one of the, I think you tweeted it out, the check to see what your legislatures in your states, how they voted on some big gun legislation.
Oh, yeah, NPR's chart. Yeah. Gun votes.
And I noticed that one of the Democrats in Wisconsin, Ron Kind, was voting totally with Republicans every time. And so, I mean, it's not just Republicans, because they haven't had a supermajority this entire time. There's enough, what do they call them, blue dog Democrats?
Yeah.
That, that are voting along with this stuff, too. And, you know, I don't know. It just reminds me of, just what's wrong with the system. But I don't know, maybe.
Yeah, well, like you said, we live in different circumstances than other countries that have some of these different regulations. Like, some of them wouldn't work for America, because We're a much more rural country. We're at peace mm-hmm. with our neighbors. We're, you know, there are many, many, many people that possess guns that are not violent criminals.
Mm-hmm.
And so it depends on how you look at the issue, and having facts would help us look at that issue mm-hmm. a lot more clearly.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, we will be back in a minute with some more talking.
What am I going to be using my profile for? What am I going to be sharing? What do I want out of Twitter? So you want to set some goals.
Are you just generally confused about Twitter? What's a tweet?
Waste your life in a struggle for power.
Be short, sweet, and to the point. It's a very fast-moving social media platform, so you can post more than once a day.
I'm going to demystify Twitter. I know most of you have heard about Twitter, used Twitter, have definitely heard about hashtags. So today I'm going to explain all of that. Follow your friends, you can follow celebrities, you can follow pastors, you can follow banks, you can follow organizations, you can follow...
All right. So we're going to do a little Twitterocracy segment. We haven't done this in a few weeks. Dave, you noticed a little Twitter, the Twitterocracy getting all into a huff about something recently, about a court ruling, which keeping the judicial theme going on here. So what was that? What that was about, the way I understand it is, now correct me if I'm wrong, retweeting is illegal.
Yeah, that's what the over-exaggeration and the freaking out online has been all about. They're like, if you take this whole thing to its logical conclusion, all of Twitter is illegal and everyone's going to jail.
Yeah. So I assume that's wrong. So where's the nuance here?
All right. So the more properly stated, the holding is that embedded images and tweets can violate the copyright holder's exclusive display rights to their image. What happened was this guy named Goldman, who's the named party in the case, mm-hmm. Took a picture, and you might understand the context of this picture better than I do, but it was, I guess, of Tom Brady, and the people he was with indicated that there was some sort of basketball recruiting going on.
Yeah, it took me a second to realize the implications of it, because I was like, oh, that just seems like rich people hanging out. What's the big deal? I don't know much about the story in and of itself, but as far as I understand, it's conspiratorial in that Tom Brady plays for the Boston football team, and the Boston basketball team was trying to recruit a prominent free agent to their athletic club. And he was somehow aiding in that recruitment effort, I think, is what the point of the picture is. It's about as lame of a thing as I can think of having a court case about, but
well,
must have been a big deal to someone.
Apparently there are people that care about this sort of thing, so yeah. That might make it newsworthy, which is something that will be relevant to a later portion of the same trial.
Okay.
But the parties decided to split up the issues into different final rulings, which sometimes happens.
Okay.
So Goldman took this picture, and he posted it to his private Snapchat with his friends. Somehow the picture leaked out of that private Snapchat to Reddit and Twitter, and it went viral all over the media. And so the tweets were embedded by various media outlets, and Goldman brought suit with this, I believe, with the support of Getty Images, but that's the way these sorts of things works. Like the case we were talking about for the California gun control, it was two guys, and then they were being supported by interest groups.
Yeah.
So Goldman brought suit against media outlets because they're the deep pocket. Like,
yeah,
you don't bring suit against XXX/Sephiroth XXX on Reddit because. Yeah. He doesn't have any money.
Yeah.
So the techies I mean, the main reason the tech people are upset with this case is because Judge Forrest is dismissive of the technicalities in the way that the internet operates, in how these images are stored and displayed, and how they're processed by the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, the Ninth Circuit goes with what's called the server rule, and that was in a case that was against, between Getty and Google earlier, where Google was displaying Getty's images in their search results. You know, you do a Google image search, and then the images themselves pop up, and you can see the image without going to whoever is actually having them.
Yeah.
And because this is all about the money. This is about not just the right to sell the pictures, but the right to get the advertising click-throughs. And Google was keeping people on their service, where you would keep seeing the images and not go to other people's service, and you would stay on the Google image search page and keep getting Google advertisements.
Okay.
And they were keeping their audience that way. And so the server rule says that the person hosting the image is responsible for the infringement, and not the person that, not the service that embeds the links or puts in the hot link. Because they made the argument successfully in the Ninth Circuit that these are the people that, this is as close to a physical possession of a thing, and they're the ones that are actually displaying it. We're just pointing at that display. And they're sort of arguing that there's an intervening third party in between their display of the image and the server storing of the image.
Okay.
But this this particular previous rule is in the Ninth Circuit, and the case that everyone's freaking out about is in the Southern District of New York, which is in the Second Circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Second Circuit and the Southern District of New York don't have to follow the precedent of the Ninth Circuit. So they're not bound by the server rule.
Yeah. And so they came to a different...
And so, yeah, so Judge Forrest came to a different decision because she decided to look at the text of the Copyright Act and the practical effect of what's happening. Like, a person goes to a website and they see the picture. The picture's being displayed in contravention of the copyright holder's exclusive display right. End of story. It doesn't matter where it is, who's pointing at it, or that sort of thing. Because, again, it's about the ad dollars. Is these media outlets see something going viral. They jump all over it. They don't care who owns the picture, where it's stored. They just point to it and say, look at us, come to our page and see our ad impressions.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they're sort of acting in bad faith here. You know, like, they're not even trying to license the picture, find out who owns it, follow it back through the history of the internet and dig through all that, because by the time they figure it out, the viral wave is going to be over and the picture's going to be worthless.
Yeah, so just to be clear, when they are embedding this image, which is from a tweet, which wasn't his tweet, right? It wasn't
right.
Goldman's. But let's even say it was. They're not seeing it. They're just seeing the picture, right?
I think they're probably also seeing, like, the words next to it. Like, they're seeing the tweet embedded in the page.
Okay. So if this had been from his Twitter account, it would... There would be a credit given then, but not a financial credit, I guess.
Yeah, and that's one of the issues that's been separated out that they're going to argue about later, is that whether or not there are any sort of defenses to the display, or whether there's any sort of fair use involved, or whether he put the thing into the public domain and gave up his rights to it by putting it on Snapchat.
He might have a tough time arguing that side of it.
Right, and that's where his lawyer comes in, because he's emphasizing that this was a private Snapchat. It wasn't actually published to, you know, Twitter and put on the internet for everyone to see. This guy never intended to show the thing to the entire world. And it's just about this one picture.
But, so I don't see Exactly. I don't really see how the media outlets, though, they don't know that he didn't intend it for public use.
Right, but they knew that they didn't have the right to display it.
Okay.
Because you know if you have the right to display an image. You go and you take it from Google and you know, I don't have that right.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, that's a good point.
But, you know, there is, apart from, you know, the kleptocracy of the internet, everything on the internet is free for everyone to take and do whatever they want with it. I do think there is some value in, like, the remakes culture and taking things and, you know, combining them in different ways and being creative with stuff that, in ways that might not, you know, comport exactly with copyright law, but, you know, increase the speed of the creativity of our culture.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's sort of the side that is getting crushed by this, because this ruling doubles down on the invalidity of rewarding mixed culture financially, even though the media outlets weren't doing anything like that, and they were just acting in bad faith and just trying to steal a couple of bucks from a viral image. You know, this is doubling down on our current copyright regime, where things are locked up, and it's not necessarily encouraging the creation of more media and more culture.
Yeah, it's a broad ruling that, you know, if we would have had rulings like this about music in 1979, we may not even have hip hop today.
Yeah. Well, how broad this is remains to be seen, because it's inevitable that this is going to get appealed. But
especially,
you know,
if there's conflicting district rulings, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So, it opens up the possibility of a circuit split that the Supreme Court might be interested in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if tech companies are dismayed with how this particular judge hand-waved away the technicalities, they're not going to get any more sympathy for that from the Supreme Court.
So, in terms of the public opinion to this, as my joke alluded to earlier, it was mostly just people going nuts on Twitter saying, I can't retweet stuff I find on Twitter. Is that pretty much what the consensus was, you noticed?
Yeah. I mean, something that's been overlooked by this is it seems that at the same time, Getty was involved in negotiations with Google to, like, they must have known that this ruling was going to come out the way it did, because that's why Google's image search last Friday, when this opinion came out, has changed. And they no longer host the images. You have to click through and go to the page that's hosting them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's not exactly because of a response to this case. That's an agreement between Getty and Google.
Google wasn't forced to do this.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting. One last question I have. Is this... So we've been living with the internet now pretty prominently in a lot of people's lives for 20 years now. Is there still a lot of, kind of like the Second Amendment, like we were talking about, which has obviously been around for 200 plus years, is there still a lot of gray area with internet technology where, you know, older rules are being being applied inappropriately to the internet or restrictively? I mean, is there still a lot of rulings in the future on how we can do things online and from companies to consumers?
The recent behavior from the FCC leaves room for a lot of litigation.
Yeah, okay, good point.
But if we're talking about the copyright and how it interacts with digital culture, I'm more along the lines with Lawrence Lessig, and that these are long, well-established rules that don't serve us well in the current environment. And they, you know, we need to look to a legislative solution to this. And the problem is that the motivations behind legislating in these in this area is not going to lead to the sort of reform that I think would be beneficial for our culture.
Well, and just the individuals doing the legislation are didn't grow up with the internet.
Right. We may have to wait for a generation of internet natives to take Congress before everything suddenly becomes, of course, that's the way we should change things.
All right. So we are recording Tuesday, and this morning another Mueller indictment came out. We were already going to talk about the more counterintelligence one from last week a little bit, but one just came down this morning, and supposedly, it's for Rick Gates's lawyer, one of his lawyers. Rick Gates is the kind of deputy of Paul Manafort. He's charged with, I think, money laundering type things. It's been reported in the past week that he was actually, I don't know if this is official yet, but he was going to become state's witness. But anyway, his lawyer apparently lied to the FBI lied to the Mueller investigation about something, and he just got charged with that, and he's supposedly going to plead guilty. He's not even going to fight that. So, I don't know. How did you celebrate that?
So many people have talked about how stupid it is to lie to the FBI or even talk to the FBI in this case because you're inevitably going to lie. And this guy's lies seem like paper thin. Like he was the project he was working on for his law firm with Gates is the thing that he lied about. It's like, of course they're going to find out. Like if that's what your work was for a year, I mean, how are you? You know, and I think his lie was something like, "Oh no, the only interaction I had with Gates was a irrelevant text message." That's okay.
Yeah, it's not. I wonder how long, because there have been reports over the past few weeks about, maybe even months, about like meetings between his lawyers and how they're stepping down, and there's been a lot of drama surrounding Gates' legal representation, and maybe it shouldn't come as a surprise that one of them's getting indicted at some point.
Right. And it also, during this indictment, it came out that Van der Zwaan's former firm, who's really famous, but I can't remember their name right now. He's is cooperating with the investigation. So that would be why there'd be a lot of change, because they would have to insulate themselves and go through all of that stuff.
Yeah, and the they were doing work for an opposition party, I believe, in the Ukraine, which is kind of what it's all about, which is who Manafort was doing work with. Isn't that what?
Yeah, they were trying to suppress the people that were against Russia's puppet regime in the Ukraine.
Yes. Yeah, so, and then the reports last week came out, I think it was Friday, that a number of Russians were indicted for a lot of the stuff we kind of already knew, although there's more details to it, but of putting out false news and all that.
Yeah, the Russian troll farmers.
Yeah, exactly, the troll farmers. It's interesting that the president is going fucking apeshit the past few days. For him even, just, like, tweeting more obsessively. I don't know what he's cutting out of his normal schedule to tweet more, by the way, since he supposedly doesn't do the intelligence briefings, and I guess he has all that executive time, but...
If he did the intelligence briefings, he might have known this stuff beforehand.
Yeah. There was something he tweeted recently where... what was it about? It was, whatever, I can't remember. I'm just going to cut this out. So the Mueller thing is heating up and getting all fun and crazy. Do you have any thoughts about that? Are you a skeptic? You're not a skeptic of it, are you?
No, but given the, given what we found out already and the level of operational security of the Trump administration, that we haven't seen explicit, direct, collusion between Trump himself and a named individual is starting to lean towards the direction of skepticism. But, you know, that's never dispositive in these sorts of things. It's always the lying to the FBI that's the problem.
Yeah. Take like Watergate. I mean, with Nixon, they had hours and hours of recordings. They got almost everyone around him to talk at least a little bit. And it's still a little bit of a gray area as to whether he knew about the Watergate break-in beforehand.
Right.
It's really hard to prove, like, well, was there a one-on-one private conversation one time before any of this? I mean, you can have a lot of circumstantial evidence that leads you to, which I think we have in this case. I mean,
right.
All of his people were at the meeting with that Russian lawyer, and talking about the Hillary dirt, and they're like a floor below where he was at the time. He was in the building. We know some of them went to talk to him afterwards. He helped cover up for it when it came out in the press months later. I mean,
The fact that he brought in Gates, Papadopoulos, and Van der Zwaan into his transition team and his administration is somewhat damning.
Yeah, and people who are defenders of the president, they use this thing where they're like, this tactic where they say, well, the only charges are for lying about it, and all they're going to get is them lying about it. It's just obstruction at worst. But there's so much lying about it, whether it's, testifying to the FBI or just in public lying to the people. It's just constant lying about it, and it just seems like, why would there be so, so much lying?
Well, that gives up too much anyway, because we've already indicted two presidents on obstruction and lying.
Yes.
Yeah, or impeached. It's, it's a...
Mm-hmm.
That's all we need. And there's other things, too. There's, you could impeach Trump on violation of the Emoluments Clause. You could, because he, because of his hotels and...
Oh, yeah, the corruption is rampant. Our profiteering dictator president, wannabe dictator president. Well, what is it? Is Trump Jr. is in India right now, or is about to be in India? And he's giving... He's, like, there to, like, recruit people for a hotel, Trump Hotel, and give a foreign fucking policy speech.
And I'm sure that they don't even see what's wrong with any of that. They don't see that they don't see anything wrong with Trump Jr. being involved in the administration.
Oh yeah, no, I think it's
like the start of that sentence is the beginning of the corruption.
I think the Trump the way I think it is that the Trump people, led by Donald himself, and maybe it's even just him, really, has no moral scruples about this type of behavior. This is just normal. He legitimately, I don't think, sees what's wrong with it. And once he decides there's not something wrong with it, it just is dominoes falling into line behind him. And it starts extending to people, you know, you and I know, or, you know, media outlets and politicians, you know, but it just starts with someone who doesn't give a shit about ethics. Never has, never will. I mean, do you think he had like ethics lawyers for his company or anyone at all who ever talked about that once?
Well, considering that his lawyer just last week admitted to an ethics violation, I find that highly questionable.
I mean, all he's done is... I mean, not all he's done, but he's always skirted around these things. And you just try. He just tries to, like, slip by. Ethics have always been something to go around or over or through.
But it's not that he doesn't understand that these things are wrong, because this is exactly the nepotism is one of the things that they accused Hillary of during the campaign. That they pounded on her giving Chelsea a job at the foundation.
So, but do you think it's more? I mean, do you think it really? I guess doesn't matter whether he thinks it's wrong. I mean, I'd almost argue that he doesn't even think that that's wrong. It was just a way to attack them. Because he knows someone thinks it wrong.
Well, it matters for the obstruction of justice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true. Huh. Well, yeah. I get uncomfortable with the conversations that are like, let's get into his head. Is he stupid or corrupt? Is he, you know... Does he know? Does he not know? It just, anytime I start trying to, like, put myself in his place, I get an icky feeling.
Yeah, because it's... Because the way he thinks and behaves is contrary to, you know, your deeply held norms and morals, and it just feels wrong to try to understand that.
Yeah, his... Like, so take, like, the Parkland shooting. He sends out, like, kind of one little innocuous tweet, like, our thoughts and prayers are with him. And then everything else kind of surrounding it was, and he does this for consistently almost every single issue, makes it about him. I feel uncomfortable even having a strong opinion about other people. In, say, there's, like, a tragic situation. Like, I don't even like to say what I think should... Like, with gun control, like, I'm uncomfortable saying this is the way to solve it, or this is what caused that guy to shoot people. Like, I don't know. I don't, you know? And I'm just some dude sitting here in a house. Granted, I'm talking into a microphone and recording it. But, I mean, he's the president of the United States, and he has no qualms about making horrible tragedies about him, or about his wins and political goals. And that amount of selfishness, I think, has always been the most distasteful thing about him. And is, you know, not, it's not like an impeachment thing. It's just he's a bad person thing.
Yeah, well, because he's weaponized indecency?
Yeah, yes. And everything else bad about him follows from that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's... And his followers, you know, the reason he picked up all of the genuine internet trolls as followers is because that's what they do. They saw a leader in somebody that thinks decency is a pretense, and that it should and it can and should be used against other people as a rhetorical technique.
That is actually, Dave, I think that might be the best summary of what's going on with 4chan internet culture, alt-right, and how it kind of coalesced behind him. I don't think it's a simple issue of just, like, pure racism, though I think that's folded into it. I think you're right. It's the pretense of decency. That's what they've always shunned ever since the early days when I first saw 4chan and aspects of Reddit. It's you know they do things just to be offensive because someone thought it was. It's like a corruption of like a punk ethos and
yeah.
Oof. All right. Was there anything else you wanted to say that's happened in the past week, or anything you know of coming up in the next week?
Well, after all that praise, I feel like ending on a high note. Like, ooh, I nailed that one.
Well, you did nail that one. Well, thank you for joining the show. Hope you can again. What is your Twitter? Say that.
Drunk Leocetus.
How do you spell that? How it sounds?
I'm going to have to look that up because I forget whether it's an S or a C. I have trouble logging into Twitter because of that. Fortunately, I'm not in charge of an emergency alert system. DrunkLeocetus.
And I'm Peter Elbro, and now you can find me on Twitter at LoadedNemesis. This has been Tell Me What to Think. I think Charles will be back next week, and hopefully he'll be back again soon. Dave, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome.
Days are sunny, days are rain. Destroy the myth that will break our chains. Break your chains!